Welcome on Human Rights Day to our conversation, A New and Unsettling Force for Human Rights. My name is Colleen Wessel McCoy. I'm part of the Cairo Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice here at Union Theological Seminary. And I have the honor of introducing Larry Cox, who is our featured speaker today. Many of you are familiar with Larry and his history and contributions to our work, but I just wanted to say a couple points quickly. He is the co-director for Kairos, the Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice, which is based here at Union Theological Seminary. He was formerly the executive director at Amnesty International USA, and he's asked me to limit his introduction to just those two points, promising to introduce himself as he talks. But I'm sure he will do so with much modesty. But it's a great honor to hear his hard-won insights on the task ahead of us and the hope and possibility for a leadership capable of moving us towards that realization. So I'm grateful to be here today, and I'm grateful that you are all here with us today. We're slated to have an hour and 15 minutes together, starting with Larry putting out thoughts and then having time for questions. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Larry.
Okay, well, hello everybody. I'm getting old, and even when I was young, I was technologically challenged, so this is all a little weird to me, but I'm going to do my best just to talk to you from the heart about human rights on this important day. And I want to start, hopefully without indulging myself too much, to just give you a little personal background so that you can, if you don't know me, can perhaps better understand where my ideas are coming from. Those ideas and my sort of lifelong commitments were shaped by growing up poor in Ohio, watching my single and very hardworking mother suffer often and greatly from economic hardship, or that is to say, from not having enough money to pay the most basic bills and always having to worry about that. Over time, I became convinced, first from watching and then participating, that the best hope to change her conditions and the conditions of millions like her was found in the power of transformative social movements, such as most notably the first one I was aware of growing up, which was the movement led by Martin Luther King and many others, but also what I found in revolutionary movements I took part in Paris in 1968, and in particular the anti-war movement and the GI movement that I was a part of in the early 1970s. By the mid-70s, both because of external repression, ideological sort of disillusionment, internal contradictions, many of those revolutionary movements had come to a sort of dead end. And at that moment, I was lucky enough to find, mainly by accident because I needed a job, another source of revolutionary power. And that is the power of human rights. And for most of the rest of my life, which happily still continues, I have been working to try to advance and strengthen human rights. First, from within a then tiny and very obscure Amnesty International, and later as a program officer at the Ford Foundation. In fact, I have worked with some of the people on this call, always trying to strengthen, expand, the human rights movement and make it successful. So the criticisms that I'm about to give of that movement and the organizations that shape that movement are in a very real sense a form of self-criticism. And I offer them in the hope that together, which is the only way anything can happen, we can find a way to reclaim and recapture both the promise and power of human rights that were proclaimed some 67 years ago today in Paris, France. I don't think working to advance human rights has ever been more important or more difficult than it is on this Human Rights Day. It's important because, as you all know, we continue to live with a long-standing and increasingly horrific human rights crisis. And by human rights crisis, I mean simply deep, massive, and most importantly, unnecessary suffering caused by the daily violations of the human rights that all governments are pledged to uphold. Sometimes aspects of the horrors of that crisis become visible and impossible to ignore. So, for example, the image of a small body of a three-year-old named Aylin Kurdi lying dead on a beach after drowning off the coast of Turkey opened for a brief moment a window to the indescribable suffering of millions of men, women, and children who, having lived for decades with the denial of rights, denial that was tolerated by governments around the world, are now caught between the hateful and vicious ideology of an ISIS, the repressive killing power of an Assad and others, and the bombing by Western powers, the same Western powers that often greet them when they flee for their lives with barbed wire, internment camps, and as we all know in our country, with rejection and demonization that goes well beyond the ugly words of just one candidate for president of the United States. There is in our country other gross violations of human rights that are no less massive, no less terrible, but are kept much less visible. Just to remind us, on this day in 1948, our government joined others in proclaiming that, quote, everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family. And as we all know, today, nearly 70 years later, in the richest country on earth, the richest country in human history, some 46 million people officially live in poverty, with another 97 million that are termed low income, which is to say that nearly half the nation, half the people in this nation are or are on the edge of being without the income they need to have a decent life. Now, poverty, like privilege, cuts across the divisions of race and gender that are so helpful in keeping people from fighting back. But like all human rights violations, they fall deliberately and disproportionately on women and on people of color. It's hard to find any sort of single image that captures the true horror of these violations. But we do know exactly what they do. They kill. They kill often, and they kill many. And not just in the ugly and terrible ways that rightly outrage us when unarmed Black men and children are shot by police. These poverty killings are usually as silent and hidden as they are massive. According to the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia, not very far from where I'm speaking, some 850,000 people died in 1 year, killed by poverty and related deprivation. 850,000 people in the United States dying because of poverty and related deprivation. Now, that's just one statistic, but like the image of that small boy who drowned near Turkey, it's a statistic that makes clear that reducing and eventually stopping the betrayal by our government of its human rights commitments is literally a matter of life and death for millions of people. And that's what makes the other crisis we face on this Human Rights Day so serious, because this is not just a human rights crisis. It's a crisis of human rights, of the movement for human rights, of the very idea of human rights. And it's a crisis that's measured not so much by what we see, but what we don't see. We don't see this widespread suffering matched by an equally widespread public discussion and protest of these gross and terrible violations of human rights. We have not seen, and we still don't see, an administration, one which was supposed to be the most rights-friendly ever, take any concrete steps to create effective ways for holding the U.S. more accountable for its commitment to these rights. We don't hear, not just presidential candidates, but almost anyone in the government, in the Congress, in the media, discuss what human rights require be done to help refugees or to end poverty. Indeed, the words human rights themselves are less and less used. Even in the president's recent Oval Office speech, when discussing the values that distinguish us from groups like ISIS, the phrase he used was, "We have a belief in human dignity." He didn't say we had a belief in the human rights that are needed to uphold dignity. And this replacement of talk about a commitment to human rights with more platitudinous and less well-defined talk about dignity or about opportunity or about fairness is increasingly frequent. It's like a similar process that has been used to replace the reality of a radical and challenging Martin Luther King Jr. with a friendly dreamer, Martin Luther King Jr. And like that process, we see now the US government coming closer than ever to success in turning the demanding requirements of rights into empty words to be trotted out on special occasions like this day. And this process of reducing human rights accountability cannot be separated from the continuing and indeed increasing violation of those rights. So I think it's imperative to use this day, especially this day, to take a hard and painful look at what we have lost and how we might regain not only the promise but the power of human rights. And the way to start that, I think, is to be clear about what gives human rights their power and about what has been done by governments and by dominant elites, often with the help of human rights groups themselves, to contain, control, tame, and take away that power. There is, of course, nothing new about governments ignoring the words of human rights that they have adopted and applauded. They did it literally for decades after 1948. And what eventually gave the words human rights their power was not the documents or treaties that governments adopted. It wasn't the ceremonial conferences held to discuss them. What brought those words to life in the late 60s and 70s, what revealed their power, were the acts of resistance by those whose rights were being most egregiously violated and the movements that those people inspire. It was the actions of people like Rosa Parks and Fannie Lou Hamer, Victor Jara and the Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo, Oscar Romero and Sister Jean Donovan, Steve Biko and Nelson Mandela, Andre Sakharov and Lena Bonner, Cory Aquino and Kim Dae-jung and many others, and their movements and efforts that they were a part of that put a face on human rights and inspired thousands of activists to take part in a new and really remarkably effective nonviolent global movement. And the courage of these people came not from faith in UN documents. It came from something they experienced deep within themselves, the rights and dignity inherent in their very being and in the being of us all. This, the reality that rights come from and are an inseparable part of every human being, is the primary source of power of the idea of universal human rights. And as that reality was turned into a kind of global narrative, it generated actions that helped to end dictatorships from Chile to the Philippines to Poland and to knock down literal and metaphorical walls of political, racial, and gender oppression around the globe. And of course, governments were forced to respond. They had to figure out how to deal with this power that they had inadvertently unleashed. Some, of course, just deny that rights are being violated while imprisoning, if not killing anyone who challenges their denial. But other governments, like ours, took more sophisticated steps to get a handle, to begin to limit the power of human rights. As has been really very well documented in books like Eyes Off the Prize by Carol Anderson, successive U.S. governments worked hard to ensure and to promise, especially to promise Southern Democrats, that nothing in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights would be used to disturb the order in the United States, and particularly nothing would be done that would harm the U.S. system of racial apartheid, lynchings, and other forms of oppression. To protect the U.S. from criticism of its record on poverty and related human rights failures, the response was simply to act as if, indeed, to assert that economic and social rights simply do not exist. At best, they are aspirations. And you have to say that all this work was done, this work of emasculating human rights was done extremely well. And with human rights kept from having domestic application, and with economic and social rights simply denied, the U.S. was ready to use human rights partially and selectively to attack our Cold War enemies, as well as to reform the excesses of some and not so powerful but embarrassing allies who also were hurting us in the global contest that was the Cold War. Meanwhile, while that was going on, the very UN that gave birth to human rights standards, but was controlled by governments that regularly violated those standards, discovered yet another way of diluting their power. And that was by channeling the concerns and energy of human rights advocates into mechanisms, complicated mechanisms of standard setting, review, and endless discussion. Now, there was always the potential that some of these mechanisms would have some real value, and sometimes they did have value. But they were also designed to be conveniently cumbersome, extremely slow, limited in scope, and most importantly, essentially toothless. And what is even more painful, for me at least, to recognize is the another way that the power of human rights was contained and over time reduced, which is ironically through developments of the very human rights NGOs that had done so much to reveal that power. Now, from the start, in the US, the NGOs that were dominant in introducing the public to human rights and defining those rights limited their work only to the civil and political rights that the US recognized. And they concentrated that work mostly on countries other than the United States. Their work on those rights proved in many cases remarkably effective. And so Western human rights NGOs gained public support, and they grew, especially from the mid-70s on, dramatically in resources, size, and number. And as they did, their work began to change. And slowly but surely, they in turn helped change the meaning and the power of human rights. Because seeking to enhance the work of human rights activist volunteers who were often, you know, raggedy and troublesome, and seeing the opportunity to sit more often at the table with governments and intergovernmental bodies, they began, not surprisingly, to professionalize, to hire people who were professionals. And these professionals often came with legal backgrounds, and not surprisingly, began to be more comfortable using legal rather than moral language. Increasingly, a largely moral movement became turned into a specialized discipline that required expertise to fully understand and practice. In short, human rights began to shift from being a movement involving all into a career for some. And I was one of the some. To keep those careers, more and more time had to be spent raising and competing for money. And this trend of the sort of professionalization and legalization of human rights was accompanied by the development of a kind of human rights fetishism. The phrase human rights and the standards, conventions, and laws built around it began to be treated as if they had a kind of magical power. It was as if it was enough to discover and describe the violations of rights without having to deal with the economic and political systems, interests, and power relations that cause those violations. Now, this idea is reflected in the celebration of a core methodology which is known as naming and shaming. This is the idea that documenting and publicizing violations of UN standards accompanied by some professional lobbying can by itself cause governments to change behavior because those governments feel ashamed, or at least they're fearful of harming the reputation. And this tactic was fueled, you know, by some real and very important gains. And given highly publicized success of the tactic, the hard and slow work of mobilizing widespread pressure from activists, let alone building sustained mass movements, was increasingly seen as an unnecessary diversion from what was now seen as serious human rights work. Unfortunately, the last decades have amply demonstrated the limits of shaming, especially when it is not backed by the mobilization of social power. It turns out that governments, surprise, are not easily shamed. if there is no real threat to their power. The tactic of naming and shaming was also seriously undermined as governments lost important incentives to take human rights seriously. For a government like the United States, once the Cold War ended, the active promotion of certain civil and political human rights as a key part of foreign policy became much less useful. And then, as we know, there came a new war, a hotter war, the War on Terror. And to many governments, again, including the United States, human rights began to look not like an ally in that war, but an obstacle to the use of their power to fight it. They also discovered that with the manipulation of fear, both justified fears and imagined fears, they could build significant public support for practices like holding people in prison without charges or even torture. Human rights activists, of course, correctly asserted that these practices were indeed shameful, but governments learned then, as now, that fear can trump shame. And then came soaring inequality and widespread economic collapse and hardship that helped to fuel mass protests like Occupy in the United States, the Arab Spring, and radical popular movements in Europe and many other countries. And now human rights, especially when those rights began to be demanded by mass struggle and used not only abroad but at home, started to be seen as what many in Washington always knew and said they were. And that is dangerous. When they go beyond respectable NGOs and are taken seriously by social movements, the demands of human rights appear threatening not only to autocratic rulers, but also to neoliberal economic and political systems and structures that appear to be failing everywhere, including in longstanding democracies. So here is the dilemma. There are many people in governments as well as other elite institutions who clearly see that the status quo cannot hold and that something serious has to be done about the growing visibility of obscene wealth for a few and increasing poverty and hardship for the many, and all of the brutal injustices that are rooted in economic and racial and gender inequality. The dilemma these liberal elites have is how to deal with those problems, you know, without going too far. How to make some changes without promoting more radical analysis and social uprisings that challenge in a fundamental way the systems that give those elites their power and privilege. And human rights is an idea that precisely draws its power from those whose rights are most violated. These are people, often raggedy people, who are likely to demand not only that the decisions being made by the elites benefit them, the people, but that they be directly involved in those decisions, in making those decisions. And for elites, that's a very messy business, especially if people assert their human rights. Human rights that are based on the radical idea that every person has them equally and that these are rights that cannot be violated do not lend themselves to the kind of trade-offs in which some are sacrificed so that others can make the economy work. They're not reasonable rights. They don't fit well with elite efforts to fix things in a non-confrontational, a polite, and a minor way. So as I said earlier, we begin to see a preference for talk not about rights, but about dignity or fairness or opportunity, anything except human rights. It's not surprising, for example, that key institutions that have played a major role in promoting human rights, like the Ford Foundation, are now downplaying those rights just as they are promising to solve the problem of inequality. But there are some places, thank God, that human rights cannot be downplayed. And these are the places that I think on this day offer us hope. These are the places where one can continue to see the power of human rights being rediscovered and renewed. Because it's a simple but powerful truth that when old ways of thinking and acting no longer work to advance the deepest desires of the human spirit, people don't stop fighting. Instead, they struggle to find new and more powerful ways to keep fighting. It may take a while before they do it, but that's what they do. And this is what can be seen if you look in the streets and in communities and not to the mainstream media, in the United States today. You can see it in so many struggles, the fight for 15, the Dreamer movement, the battle against fossil fuel and climate change and environmental racism, and the powerful Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina, the battle for Black lives in Ferguson, Cleveland, Baltimore, and New York, and across the country. Now, these are not what those who feel they're in charge of labels would call human rights organizations, movements, or battles. But in fact, they are all fights for human rights, and they bring what has been missing far too much and for far too long from those who do wear the human rights label. And that is the leadership of those most directly affected, in particular young people from all walks of life, a refusal to separate moral vision and spiritual values from explicit political objectives, a growing understanding that the oppression experienced, the human rights violations experienced, is not the result of a few individuals or bad policies, but local, national, and global systems set up to benefit and enrich a tiny minority. And they bring a spirit of resistance, often expressed in old and new song, that, like the genuine spirit of human rights, comes out of the deepest part of our very beings. Those in the streets do not need tutorials on human rights standards. What they do need is what human rights has often given to those most oppressed. First and foremost, a sense of the power of the rights that are in each and all of us. Rights that no government has given, rights that no government take away, rights that all governments are obliged to uphold. And it is the understanding of these human rights, of the way all rights are deeply connected and the way they connect all human beings, that can help create the basis for what is needed most of all. What is always needed most and is hardest to achieve when people begin, for different reasons and in different ways, to rise up and fight for their lives and for their deepest values. And that is unity. Not a perfect or an easy unity, not an organizational one, but one that comes from finding in separate struggles a shared vision and common moral purpose. A unity genuine enough to make it possible to overcome the deep divisions used to keep those who are hurting fighting each other and merely reacting to the latest horrific social disasters rather than developing enough power to transform the society that creates those disasters. This, I think, is the great human rights challenge of our time. And it's hard to overstate either its importance or its difficulty. Scholars of struggle like W.E. Du Bois or to Michelle Alexander have detailed well how the creation of different levels of oppression and denial of rights based on gender and race have long been critical in maintaining the power of an increasingly tiny minority of the most privileged. Those divisions caused by sexism and racism are real, they're deep, they're long-standing. They have to be confronted and they have to be fought constantly. But that fight cannot be won with sympathy or alliances or solidarity or with guilt, but only with a unity based on shared rights, shared humanity, and a common interest in creating a society that allows that humanity to be fulfilled for all, and especially those most denied. No one can say for sure that out of these growing struggles today, such unity can be built. All that can be said for sure is that we have the opportunity. Because, to conclude, we are living in what, in the place that I'm speaking, we call a kairos moment, using an old Greek and biblical word that means a time when old ways are crumbling and something new is trying to be born. It's a time for decisive action. But a kairos time, we also know, does not guarantee success. We know this because it's not the first time we have experienced a kairos moment in this country. In 1967, one of the greatest human rights fighters this country has ever known, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., also saw the burning need for something radically new to be born. He too had seen that when the civil rights movement began to move from the South to the whole country, when in doing so it began to become a human rights movement, and when he began to talk about economics and militarism, he saw that he also was abandoned, indeed viciously attacked by his elite allies. And he knew how difficult it would be, especially at the end of a long struggle that had torn the country apart, to build a new kind of movement that would cut across all the divides of gender and race that keep oppressed peoples fighting each other instead of the common systems that oppress them. At that moment, he called for a poor people's campaign that would disrupt the nation, force it to take seriously the suffering that was occurring. And then while working with sanitation workers in Memphis, he was killed. The poor people's campaign he called for was cut short, but the need for it has only grown, along with poverty, racism, militarism, and ecological disaster. And today, on this Human Rights Day, there are voices calling for a poor people's campaign again. There's even a website, poorpeoplescampaign.org. The hope is that this time, those voices will be heard and heeded. And so to end, I just want to read some of the words of Dr. King, which speaks so powerfully today, as they did then, about what human rights requires. In 1965, he told his staff, "We have moved from the era of civil rights to the era of human rights, an era where we are called upon to raise certain basic questions about the whole society. We have been in a reform movement, but after Selma and the Voting Rights Bill, we moved into a new era, which must be the era of revolution. We must recognize that we can't solve our problems now until there is a radical redistribution of economic and political power. This means a revolution of values and other things. We must see now that the evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism are all tied together. You can't really get rid of one without getting rid of the others." And then in December of 1967, in calling for a poor people's campaign, he said in words that, with just a few statistical updates and gender updates, could be said with full truth today. "The emergency we now face," he said, "is economic, and it is a desperate and worsening situation. For the 35 million poor people in America, not even to mention just yet the poor in the other nations, there is a kind of strangulation in the air. In our society, it is murder, psychologically, to deprive a man of a job or an income. You are, in substance, saying to that man that he has no right to exist. You are, in a real way, depriving him of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, denying, in his case, the very creed of his society. Now, millions of people are being strangled that way. And the problem is international in scope. And it is getting worse as the gap between the poor and the affluent society increases. The dispossessed of this nation, the poor, both white and Negro, live in a cruelly unjust society. They must organize a revolution against the injustice, not against the lives of the persons who are their fellow citizens, but against the structures through which the society is refusing to take means which have been called for and which are at hand to lift the load of poverty. There are millions of poor people in this country who have very little or even nothing to lose. If they can be helped to take action together, they will do so with a freedom and a power that will be a new and unsettling force in our complacent national life." That's the Martin Luther King that really lived. And to repeat, he said, "If they can be helped to take action together, they will do so with a freedom and a power that will be a new and unsettling force in our complacent national life." That, I believe, is the hope and the future of human rights in the United States on this Human Rights Day in 2015. And that's the end of my little rant there. Forgive me, I get carried away.
Very good.
So for those who joined us after the beginning, I just want to reiterate that we've muted everyone's microphones, but we do have a chat feature that you can use. If you hover at the bottom of the window, you can open up the chat and you can submit questions there, and then I'll read them aloud. If you're calling in rather than being on a computer, if you have access to email, you can send questions to Dan Jones. His email is dan@chirocenter.org. And he will paste your question into chat, and then we'll get it that way. So we want to open it up now to thoughts and questions and have Laird respond to things that are on your mind and things that his, what he has said makes you think about or points where you'd like to know more about his thinking.
I realize that I probably have answered all the questions. There's no reason for any further discussion, but it would be helpful to hear what people think. I worry because, of course, you're covering a lot of ground. That covered a lot of ground, and you, by necessity, have to oversimplify things. And also, I worry about not appearing to be disparaging of all the people that I used to work with and still work with, who have given their lives to trying to build up the human rights movement and do human rights work, because that work is still needed as much as ever. It's just that something much more is needed now. And I think it's going to come from a very different place than the institutions that we did so much to create back in the mid-70s.
So we have a question from John Alexander. He says, first, beautifully done, and thank you. Is why now, 50 years after the first Poor People's Campaign, is this new Poor People's Campaign salient?
Salient? Mm-hmm. Well, because I think that, as one of my colleagues here that I've learned so much from, Willie Baptist, always says, you can't just will something into existence. The conditions have to be also ready, objective conditions as well as the subjective conditions. And I think because of what's happened, because of what's happened while we were sort of wandering in the wilderness there for 40 to 50 years, in which, poverty has gotten worse, racism, as we've seen over and over almost every day, every week, continues to manifest itself in the killing of people of color, sexism and the attacks on reproductive. And we've seen all of this happening. People have begun to respond and begin to feel that something can be done. So there is something, happening now as happened then 50 years ago that makes it possible to once again revisit that effort that was cut short, and to say, and to simply not to follow blindly, not to pick it up because we admire Martin Luther King, but to listen to the analysis and see to what extent it applies today. And it applies remarkably well, in the sense, not that things haven't changed, not that we can do exactly the same kind of campaign, but in the sense that the kind of unity of the poor and the dispossessed, the kind of unity of people who are hurting, is the only way that we're going to be able to go forward. And what we have found in beginning to talk about this idea with people around the country who are engaged in struggle is that there is a hunger for people to come together. Everyone recognizes that we're up against tremendous odds. Everyone recognizes, first of all, that almost no systems, political, economic, social, religious, none of them are really working the way they're supposed to work. So something new is needed. Everybody recognizes that the people who have benefited enormously in the last decade, who have gotten almost all of the wealth, are not going to suddenly turn it over and suddenly say, let's change that system. They're going to use whatever power they have to keep it. And so none of us are going to be strong enough alone to be able to overcome that. And why we have to now engage in the really difficult work, as I said, of trying to overcome the divisions that have often been deliberately created. And I can go into how they've been deliberately created, but deliberately created to keep people from producing that kind of unity, from seeing what they have in common. As opposed. And we see it right now. We see voices that are actively trying to turn people who are desperate and are unhappy about their lot, but to turn them not against the people who are the billionaires or the people who have gained all, but turn them against the people who are also hurting, but are maybe even hurting a little worse than they are. So we think that there's an opportunity now to create the kind of unity that can be transformative. And our experience so far in going out and talking with the people is that that's something that is widely shared. How to do it is going to take a lot of work and a lot of effort, and no single organization or group or even group of groups, coalitions, can do it. It's going to take everybody together. But the objective conditions have never been clearer. And subjectively, you can see people fighting back and resisting, refusing to accept that we have to live like this with all of the wealth at our disposal, that we have to have people suffering like this. So that's why today I think it's come back.
We have a few great questions that have come in. There's a little bit of trouble with the email address, Dan's email address. So if you are trying to send an email to Dan and having trouble, send it instead to info, I-N-F-O, at kairoscenter.org, and he can receive it there. He'll be checking that account. The next question is from Dorothy Thomas, and she asks, how do we reconcile a common call for all people's human rights with the urgent need to focus on particularly oppressed populations, like the movement for Black Lives?
Yeah, that's a really, that's the heart of the question. So always, Dorothy Thomas is one of these people that always asks these difficult questions. So I'm not surprised. But I think the only place to start is to recognize that. I mean, you know, there's a history, certainly on the left of this country, of trying to sort of wish away the divisions, or to try to see them as secondary or somehow minor, or they should, nobody should pay attention to them. And that has never worked, for obvious reasons, because those divisions are very deep and very real. The kind of oppression that's being expressed by the movement for Black Lives is very real and deep, and it won't be wished away. So what we have to do, though, is begin to really, a dialogue that will suss out how those different kinds of oppressions are linked. What links them, of course, is the cause. What links them is the kind of systems we have that produce the racism and sexism and economic exploitation. And our experience is that if you can open up that dialogue, if you can genuinely begin not by pretending that we're all in the same place, but recognizing that we're in different places, but that we all have a common need, that people respond. And we're finding that, and we're finding the possibility, and we're seeing other people finding the possibility. I think, if you go down to North Carolina and you see the kind of movement that's been built there, it's a movement that doesn't at all, turn its eyes away from the special oppression of either women or Black lives or Latino lives, but has been able to find a common moral vision that has enabled people to come together and see the common interest in coming together. So I don't think it's easy. I don't think it will be easy. I think it's going to take a lot of hard and honest conversation and even, painful conversation. But our experience is that it can be done. And one of the things that I think, didn't happen in 1967, 68, when the Poor People's Campaign was launched, it was launched in a relatively very short time of trying to prepare it. And the kind of divisions that existed then really weren't, there wasn't enough preparation work done to overcome them. And I think we have a chance to learn from that and to learn that we're going to have to, do a lot of very intentional hard work, reaching out, talking, trying to build trust, which is really hard to do, and being honest about differences, but always keeping in front the sort of common, our eyes on the common prize, which is the kind of unity that alone can help us all. And my experience is that people are beginning to understand that alone, no single group can win.
Our next question is from Kathy Albisa. And she writes, the biggest movements we've seen today are some of the ones that you noted, Black Lives Matter, Fight for 15, Moral Mondays. There are also a lot of efforts to align the economic justice, racial justice, and climate justice agendas. What would you see as a metric of success for self-described human rights organizations? What contributions can we make at this Kairos movement? And how will we know we have made it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wish I left. This is a very awkward position to be in. Like, you have the answers to all these questions instead of just you're a fellow questioner asking how that can be done. I mean, I'm trying to figure that, all that out myself. You know, I think for human rights organizations, the main thing is to understand that these are also, you know, human rights struggles, and to not think that and that what's important is to actively work with and listen to the people in those struggles rather than lecture them about, you know, human rights law and human rights documents. And, you know, I've been part of that. That's why I'm saying this. You know, I've been part of human rights efforts to sort of instruct people about the magic of human rights. And if only they would use those words, everything would be transformed. And people don't respond well to that, nor should they. I think that the human rights organizations should be the ones, you know, who are at the forefront of, you know, working in solidarity with those organizations, listening to the people, and strengthening them. For me, the metric of success is whether we begin to see the emergence of the kind of broader connected social movement that we need. And if we're only, you know, strengthening this group as opposed to that group, or, you know, or we put our bets on this group because we think, oh, they're the ones in the media right now, so that's the one that we're going to support. And we're actually not only not solving the problem, we're creating the problem. We're deepening the problem. We have to get away from that. We have a whole history, and I know, Kathy, you know this well as well. We've all come out of the same history, a whole history of NGOism that we have to get out of, that we have to start to break away from, which is our NGO, you know, we got to raise money for, so we got to be the best NGO, and we got, and here's the groups that we're connected with, and those are the right groups, and you're connected with them. We got to somehow really struggle with each other to get out of that mentality and start talking about how we're going to build a common moral movement. And I think there are examples of this happening. And when we see it happen, we got to learn from it. And you know, I would say the biggest asset for human rights organizations would be a little humility right now. But, you know, you know as much as I do, probably.
So the next question comes from Mary Bricker Jenkins, and she says first that this is the very best Human Rights Day talk she's heard in her 73 years. And she says, please say more about why today's objective conditions, which seem so dismal, are also our best opportunity in many, perhaps hundreds of years.
Well, I think that, again, you know, first of all, the economic situation that we're in, and the sort of upheavals that happened around the Occupy movement, around the struggles that were going on in Madison, Wisconsin, the Arab Spring, did an incredible job. They didn't succeed in building a sustained, ongoing, you know, movement. But what they did do was, in a very short space of time, open the eyes of so many people to the fact that we are living in a country which is being ruled by a tiny, tiny oligarchy of incredibly wealthy people who have gotten all the goods and are holding on to them. And I think, you know, in that very short space of time, that struggle helped change the whole discourse of what's happening. Now, you know, it wasn't enough. And you know, and similarly, I think the movement for Black Lives has the way that people have responded to the killings has opened up the window on that side of this. So there's a lot of awareness and developing awareness that I haven't seen myself so widespread in decades. I mean, really. I mean, I'm just a little younger than you by apparently 3 years.
A lot younger.
I have somebody who's even, who's so old, we can't even talk about it, but Bob Zeller from the Moral Mondays movement, former SNCC person. But it's been, 40 years that I haven't seen the kind of growing awareness that I'm seeing now. I think, that doesn't guarantee, as I said, that doesn't guarantee anything. I mean, but it's an opportunity, and it's an imperative that we take advantage of this opportunity, especially imperative for you and me, because we can't wait another 40 years for it to happen again. So this time we got to take advantage of it. So I think that objectively, the conditions are really bad. People, back in 1968, when the Push for People's campaign went on, there was sort of lower working class or lower class people who were not doing well at all, were getting worse. But there was a middle class that was, advancing forward. That's why King refers to the affluent society. There was a sense that there is this affluent society and that lots of people belong to it. And that divide was very, was harder challenge to sort of overcome. Today, you don't have that. What you actually have objectively is, almost nobody gaining. Some people falling back worse. The divides that have been there for, 40 or 50 years still there. But nobody is getting better except for a tiny, less than 1%. It's not even the 1%. It's much less than 1% who are getting. And people are aware of that. And so the objective possibility of building a kind of unity between people on their common interest is greater than it's ever been. At the same time, to go back to Dorothy's question, the kind of divisions of race and gender and other divisions that have been so deeply ingrained are there. So, we have to work really doubly hard to overcome that to get to where we want to go. But I doing the work I'm doing now and traveling around the country and meeting with groups that are struggling, I have to say that I'm, full of hope, actually, not at all in despair, because it's very rare that you meet any group that's engaged in struggle that isn't aware of the need to build something larger than what we have and isn't eager to do it. So I think we got a real opportunity. I think it's, we don't have many resources. We don't have much going for us in terms of foundation support, kind of stuff. There ain't a whole lot of the elite lining up to back this. But I think that, we're objectively and subjectively, the conditions are there. So it's up to us.
Perhaps that's a good point moment for Dan Jones' question, is to ask you to talk some about religion and human rights.
Ah, religion and human rights. Well, I try, even in what I said earlier, to talk about the fact that for me, human rights has power because it comes not from, human documents or human laws, but comes from something which transcends human beings. It's something which is inside the being of human beings. So we didn't create it. It's there. We feel it. Now, from my point of view, the language I use to describe that is the language of God and the language of religious language, because that's the only language I've ever found that manages to capture what I experience, what I feel. And I think for people who are engaged in struggle, they wouldn't be engaged in struggle if they hadn't somehow connected with that inner force. That's what gives you the courage to keep going. There's no other explanation for it, because they ain't got nothing else going for them. It's not like they got a lot. They don't got foundation grants. They don't have people applauding them. They're not on television. They keep struggling because they find, and that was true for the people I mentioned earlier who started the human rights movement, they find something within them and something that transcends them. That's what religion is to me. It's not dogma. It's not, a list of what should and shouldn't be done. It's this force that people find within them. And without tapping into that force, I've never seen any successful social movement. I mean, and that's true for today. The civil rights movement, I don't think could have existed without its connection to that kind of transcendent power that was expressed. It wasn't created, but it was expressed by Dr. King and by other people. And even people who had no religious background, who saw themselves as purely secular, could feel it, could experience it. They could experience that power. Maybe they didn't call it God. Maybe they called it something else. Doesn't matter. I'm sure God doesn't care. What mattered was that they felt it, they acted on it, it moved them, it held them up and supported them. And that's what we see today. And I think that human rights, for that reason, because it's talking about the rights that are inherent in human being or being itself, is an inherently religious idea. One of the problems of human rights organizations is that they have, this wasn't always the case, but especially when I talked about the sort of professionalization, there was also a move from simply being secular in the sense of we don't want to reflect any particular religious tradition, so we're going to be for all, we want everyone to be part of this, so we're not going to have that, to becoming sort of, you know, aggressively secular in the sense of, you know, denying these spiritual or religious dimensions of the idea of human rights. And insofar as that happened, the power of human rights began to be greatly diminished. When we started out, and people like Paul Martin, who I think is on this call, knows, when we started out with Amnesty International, most of the people who were coming into that movement had deep religious roots. That's what drove them. And they were fine, very fine with accepting that this was not a religious movement, but nonetheless, they used the language of moral language, and that's what gave the movement such force. And as we began to lose that connection, we began to lose that force. I don't think we're gonna, just to give one, I talk too much, but just in Ferguson, when I was there, and we had a bunch of religious leaders who came to support the people who were struggling in the streets, and they were up on the stage doing their religious thing, and it didn't work because they were trying to bring the way human rights people do, trying to bring their messages, if these people didn't have a clue and they needed these religious leaders to tell them. And the people in the audience, the people who weren't on the stage but who were from the streets, said, yeah, they broke up the meeting. They said, if you really want to follow your faith and you want to join us, and come with us in the streets. We went in the streets, and you know, it was one of the most deeply spiritual experiences of my life to see people walking and singing, you know, God's going to trouble the water, with such power. And to me, it's an example of how people who are struggling, whatever they call it, whatever religious tradition they draw on, are deeply aware that they're connected to something which transcends human beings. And so we need to nurture and develop and understand how to draw on that power, because that's, you know, God knows and poor people know, that's the only power that you can really count on. Don't come from any foundation, don't come from any, you know, bank. It comes from within you, and nobody can take it away from you. I got carried away. Sorry.
No, that's great. Amen.
It's that force inside.
So I don't see any more questions in the queue. We have a question in the room, though. So I'm going to spin for just a minute here to Bob Zellner.
Yes. this is what we need, leadership, and everybody's hungered for it, an analysis that'll bring us together. But the young people and the people in the streets, as you point out, want to know what we're going to do. What are we going to do while we're getting prepared for the Poor People's Campaign? And Dr. King knew that he would go to Alabama, where George Wallace was, where Bull Connor was. And we now have a George Wallace and a Bull Connor who has lifted his ugly face to gather all of the forces of fascism and evil together. And he's right here in New York City. His name is Trump. Mm-hmm. So are we going to take some action in the meantime? Because that's the way you prepare for a Poor People's Campaign. How many people who are committed to jail, no bail, will go and block the doors to his establishment? That's what he understands. He understands that money and stop his business and shut him down and keep him from entering Washington, D.C.
I'm happy it's really more of a, not really a question, but really something that I just agree with deeply. And I think it's a very good point that that probably should be stressed again, which is that we're not waiting to launch a Poor People's Campaign. First of all, our view is that there is already a Poor People's Campaign going on every time that there's a struggle. And the way you develop it into something that's deeper and bigger is by action now on the ways that people can't wait. And certainly we can't wait and watch that force that you just described take over our country. And even if they don't win the presidency, so distort and divert the agenda of the country into really what can only, which can, for the first time in my life, can accurately be called sort of fascistic minds, that we have to fight against it. I just want to mention that there will be, for example, in New York City, most people are probably, I don't know where most people are, but in New York City, there will be a rally today at 5 o'clock at Columbus Circle speaking out against Islamophobia, which not only Donald Trump, but the whole host of people have been playing on, and also on the Syrian refugee situation, trying to map. So I couldn't agree with you more. I think we have to start thinking creatively about what are the actions, what can we do that's going to do it, as happened in the 60s, when people were inventing sort of the sit-ins, the freedom rides. I think we've got to once again begin to develop those kinds of actions. We just had the wonderful experience of being with Walmart workers who were taking an action, fasting in front of Alice Walton's apartment, which is on Park Avenue and 59th or something, in case you want to go visit her. She's, of course, one of six Waltons whose combined income is greater than the combined income of 43% of the American people. And these are people, choked up thinking about it. These are people who are being paid very little by this incredibly wealthy woman. So they were fasting in front. It occurred to me that was great. It was very moving. They were very moving. But, we need to think even more about what if we had found a way to really, dramatically force Alice Walton to have to confront. She snuck out, apparently, according to the doorman who was there late in the evening to get away from this. So at least we forced her to leave her apartment. And I think the same thing with Trump. I think we got to start thinking about the kind of civil disobedience, the kinds of actions that we haven't really seen. And we have to make them not a ritual. Part of the problem is that people have learned how to manage civil disobedience, so this just becomes like a little ritual. It doesn't really disrupt anything, doesn't really cause anything. The police are ready for it. They help you. They treat you, depending on what, especially, what color you are, they treat you, kindly. But we got to figure out a way to really shut down. So I don't know the answers, but I couldn't agree with you more that we're not going to develop a Poor People's Campaign by sitting around in rooms talking about it. We're going to do it by strengthening the struggles that are going on. And that goes back on. And I think to answer Kathy's question again about the human rights organizations, they ought to be out on the streets also mobilizing their people. I don't know why the human rights organizations haven't been mobilizing people to take action against what is one of the clearest calls to violate human rights openly by a presidential candidate that I can never remember. So, yeah, we should be bugging those organizations, but and they should be out in the streets organizing.
So we're close to time. I'm gonna actually unmute for just a moment and see if anybody that's on the phone that didn't have access to email wants to jump in with a question. So I'm gonna hit. So folks, if anybody's on the phone and you'd like to. Oh, actually, I missed a question. Here, let me. I missed a question from Denise. Let me ask that.
Oh, Denise.
But, yeah, hold on, just a moment. I'm mute again. So Denise, there we're sorry. Thanks. She asked, could you reflect more on the challenges of a more institutional and professional human rights groups in relationship to popular human rights movements in the US and in the world?
Denise is a dear colleague from days in the human rights work we were doing in the Ford Foundation, and somebody who I think was one of the people who struggled very much with how to use that institution on behalf of people who were popular struggles that were going on, and particularly in Brazil. And again, you know, I think that my experience of people, and Bob has even more experience, me and all the people in this room have more experience, of people who are engaged in struggle, is that they don't have any problem with people who are professional or people who are wealthy or people who want to join the struggle. They need all the help they can get. They're willing to listen to what people have to say about how they think they can help. They're willing to tell them that what they have a trouble with is people that want to come in and shape their struggle along lines that are more comfortable for the institutional forces. And we've all seen that happen. We see it now. And we see, there's always a great danger that institutions and professional institutions will not just come to try to help struggles, but will try to, take over struggles and then shape them in ways that are more compatible with their interests rather than the interests of the people who are struggling. So I think it's all a question of really, again, listening and being willing to offer the resources you have at the service of the people who are leading the fight. This thing about, one of the things about the Poor People's Campaign was the idea behind it, the core idea, was that it would be led by poor people. It wasn't a campaign for poor people. It wasn't a campaign of charity for poor people. It was a campaign to be led by poor people based on the reality that poor people were quite capable of understanding what needed to be done and quite capable of giving leadership. And I think that's a very hard concept for those of us who come out of professional organizations to grab and to hold on to. And I think we have to do some work to learn how to really listen and work with the people who are most affected and are leading these struggles. And we have to be clear about whose interests are being served and whose interests we want to serve. I'm very worried about the direction that a lot of liberal institutions, professional institutions, both human rights organizations, foundations, and others are taking at the moment, which I fear will be an attempt to channel, as I said in my talk, to tame, to control, to keep, away from too radical a direction, the groups that are leading these struggles, rather than really trying to learn from them and to really be willing to look at what needs to happen, what analysis is really true and honest about what's the source of the problems we have. And that's very uncomfortable because, the problem is not that we got a few problems with neoliberal economics that we can just fix. There's something fundamentally wrong with the whole system that we live with. And that's gonna take courage for institutions to be willing to be honest about that and to listen to people who are freer to say that, because they're bearing the brunt of what those systems are doing and they don't have any investment in those systems. If you've invested in those systems, if you get your money from those systems, if you have been funding parts of those systems, it's harder for you to listen really honestly. And I think that's what has to happen. And there's no way to do that except to go and be with the people. I mean, I had this experience of living, of thinking I was fighting for human rights. I was, I guess, I mean, I was fighting, but, you know, I just hung out with so many other people, like, you know, other professional people and well-off people. And that shapes the way you think. I mean, it was like Stokely Carmichael once said, you know, your view of the world depends on what you see when you wake up in the morning. If you wake up and see, you know, the Ford Foundation garden, you know, it changes your view of how urgent things are. Or if you wake up and see, you know, rats running across, you know, your living room. And I have in the last month or last months or last years begun to spend more time in the streets, more time with people that are hurting, more time than with people in boardrooms. And it's had a huge difference in the way I understand reality. And so I would just urge people who are professionals, who are in human rights, to get out. Don't go to the board meetings. Get out. Go to the struggles. Join with people. And just learn, because they'll welcome you. There's no doubt about that. They'll welcome you. But if you go with the spirit of, I really want to be with you, as King did.
Well, I think that we've come to the time when we said we would end for today. But the question was raised whether this recording would be made available, and we will. So we will we'll put a link to it on our website, and we will send an email to everyone who joined, or at least everyone who registered today. We'll send an email, so letting them know that that's available. So be on the lookout for that. I'm sure that I'm sure that Larry would.
Thank you.
Willie would like questions too. I'm sure that Larry would like.
I would like to be Willie.
You got a similar sounding name, but I'm sure that Larry would be glad to take further questions by email if there's thoughts that come to you, and if you want to continue the conversation online. And there will be many places soon, in the near and far future, to continue this conversation. So. Thanks to Larry, and thanks to everyone who's on the call today. If you did not pre-register but do want to make sure that you get the link when it's available, send an email to info@kairoscenter.org with your email address. So thanks to everyone. Thanks to Larry. Happy Human Rights Day.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.